This is Mae Brussel following the ski report and the weather report. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy. We're going to talk about the news of the week. For those of you who are not familiar with the program, the format is to take the news of the week and show the articles or situations that pertain to the past political assassinations in the United States. It's my contention that we had a coup d'etat in Dallas in 1963 when John Kennedy was killed, and that the news is affected by that murder and all the other political assassinations that have followed since that time. Dialogue Conspiracy is going to talk today about the Watergate trial, the appointment of Dwight Chapin, hired by the United Airlines, the rebuilding of John Kennedy's car that's going into a museum now. And I want to talk for a few minutes about the local community in Santa Cruz. This station reaches Santa Cruz. Last week when I was going on the air, I had an article about a girl who was murdered in our local area. And Dialogue Conspiracy, when I talk about political assassinations, I want to make it clear that you don't just overthrow the government by taking one particular person and getting rid of him, and then everything is back to normal. There is a reason to overthrow the government, and there are techniques of committing crimes and concealing them, and the purpose is to control centralized power in the hands of a select few. And the methods of control are very, very many, because this is a large country and you have to control many facets of that nation. And one of the important things that is happening now that we're going to see in the next year or two is increased violence that is planned, similar to the special forces of the Green Berets that went into Vietnam and provoked situations as an excuse for our troops to come in and save the Vietnamese people from the North Vietnamese. The war has come home for a long time, and there are many massacres, family massacres, multiple slayings that serve purposes in the Cold War, which exists at home. Last week when I went on the air, there was an article in the paper, Why Was Cynthia Murdered? Cynthia Ann Schull is a young girl going to Cabrillo College who was murdered, and parts of her body were found in the Carmel area, parts of them were found in Santa Cruz. The San Jose Mercury mentioned that Cynthia was going to be a witness for the defense in a narcotics case before the Superior Court in Santa Cruz. Now, the usual denial was she couldn't have been murdered by the prosecution. This is what the district attorney is saying. The prosecution wouldn't kill her, and she was no threat to the defense. Therefore, there's no relationship to her murder at this time to the testimony she was going to give, which is absolutely ridiculous, because in studying political assassinations and guerrilla warfare at home and the way fear is spread throughout this country, in particular civil rights, people are murdered or witnesses to political assassination. The people that plan the assassinations or are part of any conspiracy eliminate all witnesses that would prove who was doing the planning of the murders, and the defense always is made to look guilty. They're the patsies. And the witnesses to the defense are killed. In the case of like Lee Harvey Oswald, if he were alive and had a trial of the rooming house lady that saw him come back, the police car that honked, the taxi cab driver that was supposed to take him down the street, the bus driver, they're all dead. One by one, all the witnesses that were in Jack Ruby's apartment or the woman who made the reservations at the hotel where Martin Luther King stayed, the woman who was in the boarding house where James Ray was supposed to have left after the shooting, these people are either locked up in insane asylums or they're dead. And the witnesses for the defense are the ones who are getting ripped off. The Santa Cruz murder I've followed for several reasons, and it's terribly important for our local community. And I think you should become aware of the techniques not only of killing political leaders like men running for president or senators or congressmen, but in your own local community, you have to be very, very careful now, because people are going to come in and infiltrate, and it's a three-pronged purpose. You can get rid of particular people that you want at the same time. You confuse the motives, and you accomplish the fear, which then requires more control on the part of the police. In the Santa Cruz there, following the finding the parts of Cynthia's body, five other people have been murdered. A Kathy Francis, 29, and her two children, aged 4 and 9, and a James Guinera, 24, and Joan Guinera, 21. Now, these five people have been murdered by the same weapon, the same bullets, .22, and they were friends of each other. There were two separate homes, but these families knew each other. And the police say, we have no clues, there's no suspects, there's no weapons, no arrests, no motives. Now, the terror comes down on the hippies or the subculture living in the hills, and they all want to get out. Following the Otis slaying, where the family was massacred just 2 years ago, the town came down on the counterculture, which it's supposed to react in that way. And the solution to this murder of these five people is left up to the air. The excuse for not finding who is murdering these five people is that when you live in a subculture, I'm quoting the newspaper now, San Jose Mercury, the 30th, it says, when you live in a subculture, you allow people to enter your homes who are total strangers, and the people who live in the straight world would never dream of allowing anyone except a close friend into their home. So they're saying it's very hard because these people live in a subculture to allow persons into your home. I might mention that Mrs. Ganera was raised, the lady that was murdered, was raised in the Santa Cruz area. Her parents are well known in Quaker circles. Mr. and Mrs. Herb Foster are her parents. They are peace advocates. Her father ran for candidate for Congress 2 years ago from the Peace and Freedom. Her mother's active in the Head Start and child care programs. They are culturally anti-war, anti-establishment in their behavior. Their daughter has been murdered. And the police say, well, if you're going to allow subculture into your home, what are you going to do? And the reason I say beware is that an incident came up with a particular person who listens to my shows every week and is on to the kind of dialogue that we have. And he moved down to Big Sur and reads a lot of book on political assassinations and writes letters to other researchers and came out of a store just 2 weeks ago, or a week, it was about a week and a half ago, down by the post office at Big Sur. And there were two men on the road that he thought looked like they were waiting for him. He was very suspicious of their approach. They had a handful of groceries. And they asked this man, what do you do? How do you earn a living? What do you read? And they began to ask this friend a lot of questions. And he asked them in return, where are you from? One was from Texas and one was from the Special Forces. He said he was just out of the military, but he was the military Special Forces. They said, we have a bunch of groceries. Can we come to your home and cook them on your stove? We'll share our groceries if we can cook them on your home. Now, this particular friend got very frightened, and he felt they made other suggestions that his life could be in danger. They asked if he believed in life after death and made some really frightening overtures that he felt very uncomfortable and didn't stay down at his cabin in Big Sur and thought that he really thought that he could be murdered, that these people were dangerous and that they were coming in, and he responded accordingly and left there. Well, this is the kind of people who can come into a community like our Special Forces going to North Vietnam. They go into a home, let me use your stove, let me be your friend, and your first instinct is to share your home. The counterculture is not the straight world. We do not have a lot of locks on the door, and the door is somewhat open, and there was an attempt to have trust for each other. So then the police can come down and say, well, how could we ever find who murdered these five people? Because they let the straights into their home. It seems that whoever murdered these five people knew them well because they had watchdogs that didn't bark, and they were eating food at the time they were murdered out of the refrigerator. Well, this is what happened, the Sharon Tate massacre, which was a planned massacre by the law enforcement agencies in Los Angeles to come down on the counterculture. The dogs didn't bark, guns went off, and nobody came and was alarmed, and the stabbings and the gunning was exactly like the Sharon Tate LaBianca murder, the one up that took place in Santa Cruz this last week. The important thing is that you, if you are from a hippie subculture or whatever your culture, try and get the background of people that approach you and realize that there's going to be a lot of terror in our communities in the next months and year ahead. There are going to be a lot of family massacres. There's going to be a lot of spreading of terror. I predicted this a year ago, 2 years ago, and it's going to keep coming down heavier as the power structure begins to gain more control. They'll have the excuse of the data banks and surveillance to watch the killers, knowing full well that they have let those particular killers get away or have selected patsies that are going to take the rap. It was also pointed out that the man whose wife was killed, as Mr. Francis, was about to go. His name is Robert Francis, and he's alive. And his wife was murdered, and he was about to go to the police department on a traffic warrant. And they were afraid that he would talk. He knows about a drug operation up in the Santa Cruz area between Marysville and Santa Cruz. And the suggestion was that he knew about a drug operation. So what you have here is a family that knows something about a drug operation that is called in on a traffic warrant. His family's wiped up. You have this Cynthia Schall, who's going to testify for the defense on a narcotics operation. The man that she's going to testify for said that the district attorney's office had told him to leave town. Witnesses can be eliminated for trials. That's one thing you do. You automatically keep them from telling what they know to crack the real narcotics traffic up there. You come down on the hippies at the same time, and you come down on the peace people and hurt them at the same time. The third thing is you spread terror and among the people in distrust of the youth and the counterculture today and try to pull them all back into the straight society. And the fourth thing is you get more police force. And that is what it's all about up in Santa Cruz. So be careful and keep your eyes open for people that are passing themselves off and entering your home. The John Kennedy car is going to be retired. We're going to talk about that because the limousine in which John Kennedy was assassinated is going to a museum. I've done research into the John Kennedy assassination for 9 years, and I've followed the Martin Luther King, the Robert Kennedy assassination, Malcolm X. But the largest piece of evidence that was destroyed in any of these assassinations, the really big test was getting the car off. You see, if you could find out who destroyed the interior of John Kennedy's car, you'd find out who is doing all the political assassinating in this country. And I think that it's time that Congress pass some kind of a law, or the Justice Department, and they obey their own law, that anybody who destroys a piece of evidence in a criminal case or when arrest is made from that moment on would receive jail, 10 years in jail or $10,000 fine, no matter who gives the orders to destroy it. You get this down with Ellsberg now. When he was talking about the Pentagon Papers, there was orders from the Pentagon, destroy the evidence that would show that he didn't give away national security. You have this in a new suit with in Washington now where evidence was destroyed, the IBM case, that vital evidence has been destroyed, and they're supposed to go before the Justice Department. You have the Watergate case where the men testified at the trial this week. The judge said, well, didn't you have a record of who got the money and the funding for this process? And the answer was yes, it was destroyed. Well, the first big piece of evidence that was destroyed that I came across when I was researching the John Kennedy assassination was John Kennedy's car. The car was taken by airplane to Washington for about 24 hours, and then it was taken to Dearborn, Michigan, where, as the paper tells you today, it was 90% ripped out. It was 90% taken. Only the frame was left, and it was taken apart. Well, the man had been murdered 48 hours earlier. Mr. Kellerman of the Secret Service was sitting in the front seat of that car, and he told the Warren Commission a flurry of bullets came to us. And they said, you mean one? And he said, I've been in this too long. It was a flurry of bullets. Well, if the car had been examined, and it should have been examined, even if there was a Texas commission or a simple basics of criminology, I should think would be to look at that car. We would have been told how many bullets were in that car, because we know that Oswald's rifle could only get off so many in a certain time period, even if he owned a rifle, which he didn't. It would tell you the direction that the bullets came from. You could tell the distance that the bullets came from. They've got the scientific methods of telling how far, with what speed they came from. You could learn what weapon they came from, or what weapons, if they were the same. This car was picked up and totally destroyed. It was never saved for historic purposes. And not only was it picked up, but the lamppost in front of the Texas School Depository was picked up that evening, and so was the street sign in front of the book depository. They were probably nicked with pieces of bullet or had evidence that they had been hit in this crossfire, too, which was a military operation in Dealey Plaza. So now there's a subject about turning it over. This week it said, the Associated Press, probably to a museum. And just to make matters even more ridiculous, they referred to the auction of Hitler's car this week. And the limousine, they're not going to auction it off. It gets first choice to the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan. And then after that, if they don't want it, it could go somewhere in Washington. But the Ford Museum has the right to this car. I certainly think they should have it. There's nothing of any value in that car if 90% of it was rebuilt. I want to talk now. We're going to go to the Watergate. The case is over. That was the quickest trial for such a serious matter that I could imagine, but I knew it would go that way. In July, when I wrote in The Realist about the arrest of the Watergate, I described exactly what kind of a trial or investigation you'd have. There is no way that the prosecution is going to run a trial when they're part of the system that did the espionage work. They're not going to investigate themselves. But just to show the state that this nation is in, the Newspaper Guild had an award that they gave this week to Washington Post writers Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, and they did the fantastic job of covering daily the actual information of the Watergate as it was coming out, going around the country, interviewing people, which the FBI wouldn't do, the Justice Department, the Washington Police Department. But what the Newspaper Guild said was, in quotes, "These reporters were cited for enormous odds against which they worked, like secrecy, implicit administration, intimidation of their potential sources, explicit verbal attack upon the reporter's credibility, the newspaper's credibility, its owner, and its editors." So what we're really saying is that a group of people was arrested, bugging the entire Democratic Party and the Democratic process, and an award of bravery to the reporters who went against all the odds, instead of all the newspapers in the country trying to cover this story and get to the truth of the matter. They played the same game they played with the political assassinations. And someday they'll be sorry, because now the newspaper media is beginning to hurt. They're feeling the squeeze of the fascism that they have helped support. Dwight Chapin got an appointment to United Airlines in Chicago. Some of you know his name and some of you don't. He was the appointment secretary for Richard Nixon in the White House. He had a very important job and made the arrangements for the trips to China and Russia. Dwight Chapin was named by Donald Segretti an agent provocateur, a registered Democrat who was actually a Republican, who stationed at Fort Ord for a while, the judge advocate's office, flew back and forth to Washington, received espionage money from Donald Segretti in the White House and also from Herbert Kalmbach in California, Nixon's lawyer. Dwight Chapin in the White House worked with Segretti in this espionage operation. Segretti, who also worked with Chapin, met Howard Hunt in Miami, where he was to hire hippies and radicals for the convention. So that the White House team of Dwight Chapin and Hunt and Agent Segretti was very close. Segretti worked with Kalmbach. That was the lawyer who took Martha Mitchell to the hospital for stitches when she was hand was thrown through a window out in California, and John Mitchell was gone somewhere, staying at the hotel with the acting head of the FBI, Patrick Gray, and the whole espionage squad was flown out to California for a big conference. Segretti, who worked with Dwight Chapin, also worked with Kalmbach and Martha Mitchell. None of these people were called at the trial that took place that the government prosecuted. Martha Mitchell said the men should be arrested. She referred to cops and robbers game. None of the cops or robbers were brought to the trial. Segretti, Kalmbach, Martha Mitchell, Chapin were very close. Now, Dwight Chapin is leaving the White House. Of course, he denies that his leaving there at age 32 has anything at all to do with the Watergate. Nothing at all, we've been told by Press Secretary Ziegler. But where is he going? He's going to work for the United Airlines in Chicago. Now, that's an interesting location for an espionage agent who's tied in with his whole team and secret funding that comes through the White House for hiring hippies, radicals, provocateurs. He's tied in with this group. The United Airlines in Chicago was the airport and the airline that Mr. Hunt's wife, Howard Hunt's wife, was on when she was killed. She was flying out to Chicago with $10,000 of CIA money, $100 bills, defense money for her husband and the team. In her purse, she had the name of two neurosurgeons and a hypnotist. She was flying United Airlines when the plane crashed. I was incensed at the time and reached various people investigating this crime, but my naivete never ends. You have to know that when situations are used, people are used, airlines are used, there is the possibility that they're already covered, the conditions are met. What does the United Airlines lose in one little plane? It's just $7-10 million, you know, because to the CIA to replace that plane is nothing. If they don't have to be investigated, if there's not a lot of lawsuits, 45 people were killed on that plane and homes were destroyed. But 45 people aren't going to investigate that because they're not into political assassinations. They don't connect Mrs. Hunt as being part of an espionage team. And I'm sure they're not going to connect the fact that Dwight Chapin is going to move to Chicago, where there would be investigations of this particular plane crash. Now, last week I mentioned that the pilot on that plane crash died from cyanide poisoning. And the investigative team said they've never tested the intestines of pilots before. The bail money for Howard Hunt, he pleaded guilty, was several hundred thousand, $100,000. He's borrowing the $235,000 from his wife's death. He's out. She was doing their errands. He's using the money. He's not in jail. So Dwight Chapin is going to work for United Airlines in Chicago, right from the espionage desk of Richard Nixon. He's going to cover that office in some capacity. And he is an agent, an espionage agent, and he'll sit in that Chicago office. So you can be sure that even when commercial airlines are used, we're never going to get at the bottom of who is doing all this manipulating. The lives are cheap in this country. They're cheap in Vietnam. 45 or 50 doesn't mean a thing if you have to accomplish your goals. Richard Kleinitz came out this week. He looks very noble. He offered to let us have all of the FBI information on the Watergate case. He says the Justice Department couldn't hide that investigation if we wanted to. In quotes, he said it would be impossible to do so because the investigators and prosecutors would not permit it. But, he said, I have to tell you, there's only one thing involved. You can't have any of the FBI material until the appeals of the defendants in this case are over. And he goes on to say, this is the Washington Post article. He says, we do have to hold back litigation on this material, and there are limitations and embargoes. So he told the Senate aide that that will mean 8 or 10 years. After the noble speech that he is going to let you have all the information, the truth will come out, it would be a disservice to the Constitution to not allow it to be impossible. Not, he says, I have a duty to uphold the Constitution and enforce the law. You can have the material in 8 to 10 years. That is the height of insanity. And no matter how you look at it, it's an insult to our intelligence if we think about it. Now, what is the solution? I think one of the solutions is to write to the members of Congress. This evening's news said that the Senate investigators have knowledge of a wide range of sabotage and espionage. And I maintain that this goes all the way back to Dallas and even before Dallas. Our own homegrown political assassination, the most obvious was the John Kennedy. I maintain that we should tell those seven men that were arrested at the Watergate, two were found guilty, five pleaded guilty. No appeals. You're free. You don't have to be arrested. There's no bail. You can have amnesty. Let them out. Let them go earn a living because your tax money otherwise is going to pay them anyway. The CIA is going to pay them large amounts of settlement money. They're getting $1,000 a month just to sit around. Let's drop the whole case and investigate. If we can't investigate for 8 or 10 years, the espionage team that's been running our government, say, forget the appeals. Drop the charges. That wasn't a trial anyway, you see. And let those men off. Don't put them in jail. Let's go for the top boy. These seven are taking the rap for the team that paid them the money to do the work. The few men that were at the trial admitted they had $200,000, $299,000. They lied. They didn't know where it goes. Mr. Baldwin testified at the trial. He received tapes, delivered them to the White House. He told the Los Angeles Times and other news media long ago that he delivered him to Mr. Timmons at the White House. At the trial, he says he doesn't remember who he gave them to. Mr. Timmons is the liaison of the White House to the Congress for the next 4 years, an espionage agent. They say if you have any problems now, the White House is open to us, Mr. Haldeman, Ehrlichman. Congress, you come tell us what you want, and we'll look it over. Well, by doing that, they know where everybody's head is at. They know how to arrange for them not to be reelected. They know how to sabotage their offices. They're all bugged anyway. This came out in the Watergate trial. Their telephone conversations are bugged. Who they see, who they meet, their families, they're blackmailed at every level. So I think the thing is to forget about the trial. It wasn't a trial. Tell the men to get off. Let the seven go and go for broke. Because, see, Congress was going to call in Martha Mitchell and John Mitchell and Maurice Stans and Mr. Timmons and Dwight Chapin. Let's get everyone but Richard Nixon, because they all do it for him. This is why it's all done, so that he can be president. Now, he says he won with a mandate, therefore he can drop all your benefits. Did you read the paper this week about health, education, welfare, money being pulled away now from every benefit that helps society, but the military budget went up, the ecology is going to be put aside because, in quotes, there's a fuel shortage. Wasn't that planned a long time ago that we would have clean air, except we have a fuel shortage, totally manipulated? The thing to do is to go in there now and say, drop the charges. Mr. Klein, if you're waiting for the litigation, drop it all. We don't want to wait 8 or 10 years. Either you get out or let us go on with the trial if you're going to talk about it. Now, I have a few things to say about the trial. The judge has admitted that the questions were left unanswered. You see, he can come on very big and say, I want everything answered. But when the prosecution's evasive, when the witnesses are evasive, he lets it go. When it's important things, he lets the jury out of the room. The same old techniques they use for all of these trials. Incidentally, while I'm talking about the Watergate, I'm going to take calls for the next 15 minutes on any of these things or any conspiracy subjects that have come up during the week. If you call in, 624-3859. I'm just going to give the name of two excellent articles that I want you to read if you get a chance. 624-3859. The judge said the questions were unanswered. He didn't believe the motive about wanting to get the radicals. He didn't think it was the right motive. But then he said to the jury, Judge Sirica made a great speech and said, you made a real contribution to justice. How can the jury make a contribution for justice? The guilty weren't called. The people that were part of it, five pleaded guilty right away. The judge didn't have to take that plea. He could have had the whole truth come out. It lasted a few more days where the two sat there grinning, winking at each other, laughing, knowing the appeals would go on for 8 or 9 years. And then the judge said, the prosecution lawyer, Mr. Silbert, said to the jury as they went out to vote, you can restore the faith in our democratic system that we have had and in the political system that has been so badly damaged by the defendants. The defendants have been damaging this political system since 1960. I have two articles. I'm going to take this call, and then I'm going to tell you about the new article in Computer and Automation and one in American Opinion, both very important. Yeah.
Well, you were talking about the fuel shortage and what they were going to do about it. They are planning on building a fleet of super tankers to rob the oil from the world. And I read in the paper today, the San Jose Mercury, that Monterey Bay is one of the places where they're planning on maybe making a port for these super tankers. Just thought everybody would like to know that.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty bad, and they're going to really fix up Monterey Bay. It brings down the property value, ruins the beauty. There's a systematic ripoff to destroy a lot of the things that we have, and then people lose interest in protecting anything. You know, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now. Okay. Hello. Okay. There's an article. Oh, and Computer and Automation has an article that a lot of you can get at the universities here. Monterey Peninsula College carries computer and automation, and the Navy Postgraduate School, and up in Santa Cruz at the library at the university there, and Cabrillo College, and out in Salinas at Hartnell, they do take computer and automation. And there's an article by Richard Sprague, a continuation in the Watergate series, on Richard Nixon, the Bay of Pigs, and the Watergate incident. And it is similar to the links that I implied when I first did the Watergate story. That was completed in July for The Realist. This goes farther into Richard Nixon's role in 1959 and 1960, working with McCord, Liddy, Hunt, the same team that was involved and arrested at the Watergate, the espionage squad that worked out of the White House. Like your news release says tonight, that this espionage squad worked from the White House, worked closely with Richard Nixon. Well, Richard Sprague has a wonderful article on the fact that Richard Nixon, in his campaigns in 1960 against President Kennedy, admitted later in MI6 crisis that he told lies for patriotic reasons. He used the word for patriotic reasons, and to cover the covert operations of the Bay of Pigs. Now, he was involved heavily with the anti-communist groups, and he worked, he admitted lying to the American people then to protect Mr. Hunt and Barker and Sturgis and McCord. And this was in 1960 that he was working with them. So if he admitted he lied in 60 to work with those same agents, you know that he has to be lying. He's working with the same crew in 1972 at the Watergate Hotel. Now, Howard Hunt was the organizer for the Bay of Pigs, and Charles Colson was described as one of the CIA agents for covert black espionage training. And Charles Colson worked with Howard Hunt, and there's a strong team that worked together in 1960 at the time when Richard Nixon lost to John Kennedy. And this is when I said that the decision was made to kill John Kennedy. The minute he won the election, the decision was made to kill him. Kennedy was briefed at the time of the Bay of Pigs by Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, who later was on the Warren Commission and took care of all the evidence of conspiracy and personality and wrapped up the concealment of Oswald, the agent, and made him look like the cover story that he was a communist. This is a very good article on the background of Nixon with the same team that worked in the White House under Eisenhower and down in Florida with the Bay of Pigs and was working in 1972, still playing around with the electoral process. There also is an excellent article, Computer Automation. This is January 1973. It just came out this week on the Frenchman who was to kill Kennedy. And that's the gentleman I've talked about before, Mr. Romero. Jose Romero, who was to kill Kennedy in France and was approached by the Secret Service and offered $400,000. He was given a Swiss passport. He was given an alias and membership cards to certain clubs. This is the way James Ray got around and moving to Canada, and he had aliases and passport, and Oswald had them, and Sirhan had his $400 of CIA money ready to split and the key to two cars, and false documents. These people, they're all made by the Central Intelligence Agency. But Romero changed his plans and hid and got away. He knew that he would be killed. He said he'd be killed, and he knew, just the way Oswald was killed, that after he accepted the job, he would be murdered. So he left the street where he was supposed to go through with the plans and went down to work in the Congo, and only this year spoke about the plans to kill Kennedy. And he said that his hair is very white, and it turned white at the time that he heard that Kennedy was killed, that he was terribly frightened and realized that this was the same group. Now, Mr. Romero is supposed to have identified two of the Watergate men that were arrested as being the men that approached him for killing John Kennedy. CBS was supposed to have, I've read this in literature, I've received phone calls from various researchers that he has identified two of these particular men. So you see, the important thing isn't to get Mr. Liddy in jail or James McCord in jail, because we don't want them locked up, and they're not going to pay their fines anyway. We're going to pay it. So we really just want to find out what's going on. You see, when they were guilty, the verdict of McCord could be 45 years in jail and $60,000 fine, and G. Gordon Liddy, 35 years and 40,000 fine. They're going to be out in about 3 years like James Hoffa and Bobby Baker. There's no way they're going to sit in jail that long. Right now, they're all out on bail except their underlings. And again, this is the funny part about political assassinations and racism and using people. And men like Martinez, Barker, Sturgis, and Gonzalez are in jail. They don't have the bail money. The ex-Cubans, even though they are actually American citizens, now they're Cubans their families are from Cuba. And these men are lower on the social strata in the eyes of even the conspirators. Their buddies, the four of them, are in jail after servicing them, and Barker's so loyal. Dahandi calls him the greatest American, you know, that he could serve. It's been a privilege to work for him and McCord. He is in jail. They're in jail. And Liddy and McCord and Hunt, the top dogs, the rich men, the men with the $200,000 homes, they're out. Bernard Barker is wealthy. He was written up in Sundance magazine as being a millionaire, a friend of Richard Nixon and Bebe Rebozo. But he's still in jail. No bail money. But the other three are out, so why not let them all out, and we'll find out what's going on. Now, there was an article this week on Big Brother, and it has to do with James McCord and the plan to take over censorship of mail and a dictatorship. It talks about the article that I'm referring to is an appeal by Alan Stang of the American Opinion. Here is the point in history which we're coming to, which we're finally beginning to see things together. The Los Angeles Star, which is a underground paper similar to the LA Free Press or what the Berkeley Bar was like, it's filled with nudie pictures and all kinds of pornography. The Los Angeles Star included in its issue with all the nudies the article from the American Opinion by Alan Stang on the CIA involved in trying to kill George Wallace. So that the far right wing that wouldn't associate with any literature, any publication like this, is now allowing their material to be put in with a paper like the Los Angeles Star, which has to come wrapped up and sealed because it wouldn't pass through the mail if it was open. The Birch Society, to get their message across, will use and share the Star, and the Star, which is directly a counterculture kind of thing, will print Alan Stang's arguments on the Bremer, the shooting of Walls, was an outright conspiracy. So American Opinion is another magazine, and they are appealing. They're appealing. It's a long article. It's an excellent article on Big Brother and the dictatorship that's going to come. They're asking the liberals and the conservatives to get together to stop the totalitarian conspirators. Now, I've said all along that my research is not Republican, Democratic, Communist, Radical. I only want to see America stay on a track where, if it didn't meet what the Founding Fathers were talking about, it had the hope that someday it would. And when you have these political assassinations, you lose all that hope. So what you're finding now is a magazine, Alan Stang, in the American Opinion, has 16 pages, and he's talking about James McCord and political assassinations the way I talk every week on political assassinations on this program. And he's begging people, I'll read you some of his article, to get with it. He said it's like 1984, and he's talking about the censorship plan and Congress's decision on the DIDS, the Decision Information Distribution of Defense. And he talks about the construction of powerful low-frequency transmitters that were to begin in early 72 to reach 50 million people. And the messages would come from the government. They could wake you up at night. And it fell under the Office of Emergency Preparedness. Congressman Moorhead pointed out this Office of Emergency Preparedness because James McCord, who was arrested at the Watergate, was on that committee and headed that committee in the White House. And Congressman Moorhead had said that the national censorship planning would involve opening your mail, monitoring your broadcasts, and would have a national watch list. McCord and Hunt and Liddy worked with Robert Mardian and John Mitchell, the Justice Department, who had a list of everybody they wanted to get who would speak up against oppression in this system. Or the misdeeds that our government is doing under the guise of protecting us and allowing further repression through legal means, changing the laws to fit their needs. Alan Stang quoted Moorhead as referring to the Special Analysis Division, which plans to overthrow the government. He said, when men like James McCord, and James McCord is one of the men arrested at the Watergate, are involved in political espionage and are responsible for the official collection of information through a censorship system, I have no doubt that the national watch list will pinpoint individuals slated for political reprisals. Now, you see, the Birch Society knows that people are going to be singled out for reprisal. Censorship, it says, is one of the key hallmarks of a totalitarian dictatorship. A dictatorship without censorship would fall apart, and the electronic hardware available to Richard Nixon makes possible a system of censorship and propaganda compared with which Joseph Goebbels would look like an amateur. Children are being born and given social security numbers. The government says it will, quotes, help them. Is this to take the place of tattoos and on their forearms as in Nazi Germany? I'm reading Alan Stang from the Birch Society. The signs of the coming dictatorship are clear. We must get together with liberals, he says, like Congressman Moorhead. No one can call him a conservative. He ranked zero on the conservative indices. And the same holds true for Senator Charles Mathias Jr. of Maryland, who's leading the fight in the Senate to restrict the president's emergency powers. But he went on to say that the liberals and the conservatives must join forces to stop Richard Nixon and the totalitarian conspirators, and they must do it soon. So you have the Birch Society quoting the liberals. You have the LA Star printing the Birch Society, all aware of the dangers lurking. This week in the newspaper, that article in American Opinion was written a month ago, I guess, because it was just mailed out, was an article, the military is to test a bedside radio disaster alert. The civil defense, see, they're going to protect you from earthquakes and disasters. How many do we get in our lifetimes? And every radio in the homes, it will be mandatory to install it. And the inclination is that Big Brother will be here in 1984. The setup, it says, will set off and warn you of a nuclear attack. I think we should take a vote and say, I would rather have a nuclear attack, which we're not going to get, than a radio in every home. But the Associated Press, January the 28th, this week, is calling for the decision information distribution system, which is being built by North American Air Defense in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And that's what the article in the Birch Society is about. It's in the paper this week. It'll cost $10, they said, as much as anyone can afford, and every home will get a receiver. We have time for one call before we go off the air now. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out something along the lines of what you were just talking about. In San Francisco, they have already approved a plan to install TV sets around the city. You know, they call it traffic control, but it has the power to zoom in close details. You know, like it can focus on individual people, and well, they're calling it for traffic control, but it can be used for a lot of other things.
Don't we have that now out in Seaside? Aren't there police that can photograph inside walls and see what's going on in front of homes blocks away now?
I don't know.
I heard about that they were using those now.
Yeah, well, I just thought I would mention that. Okay. As long as you're talking about it.
Yeah, well, our time's almost up. What do we do with this dreary news? I think we write to Congress. Last week I was telling you, write to Sam Ervin. I told you last week. Right? Oh, we're going to write to Sam Ervin and open up the Congressional Committee on the Watergate, but that's going to take 10 years. So save your postage stamp and tell him this time, write to your congressman in lieu of the news tonight of the espionage squad and the White House and Richard Nixon. Let the seven men that said they were guilty or were found guilty free, give them amnesty and find the men who paid them to do the jobs that they were doing. Well, that winds it up for this week, and we'll see you next week, and maybe we'll find some happy news we can talk about for Dialogue Conspiracy.